Once I was properly in the saddle, I could do anything the lawful occasions of rough mountain travel demanded, even to picking things off the ground or dismounting mounting on the wrong side, or waving slickers to head pack animals, or shooting a gun, anything, anything at all. That was for me. But he was not so tolerant of others. Indeed, I did not permit others to ride him after a friend of mine, a fine rider, found himself on one side of a high sharp picket fence and bullet on the other, when the dust had cleared. That is, I permitted no others but Betty. She could not reach both the pommel and the stirrup from the ground, so she wound the saddle strings around her hand and literally shinned up Bullet's foreleg, and Bullet turned his head to watch benignly, standing like a rock until she was well settled in the saddle, his ears on the half-slant of virtue. My picket fence friend was horrified when he first saw this performance. "It's criminal," he expostulated vehemently. "Some day he'll kill her." But I knew better, and so did Betty. And so did Bullet. Anecdote of this sort I could recall by the score. But one other picture seems to insist. One day the Austin Strongs, Betty and I were wandering through San Francisco's open-air zoo. Betty was some distance ahead of us. We saw her stop for a long time before a cage in which dozed a great lion, broadly oblivious to the throngs of people passing or trying vainly to attract his attention. After a time Betty walked away. That lion opened his eyes, got to his feet, followed to the end of the cage, lifted his head staring after the tiny figure just as far as he could see her in the crowd. Then he sighed, lay down again, and closed his eyes. We pursued Betty. "What were you doing to that lion?" we demanded. "I made him pictures," said she simply, "pictures of the African veldt." I shall get no further piling up such incidents. After all, it is not really a portrait that is intended, but only to show a training in spirituality. Granted that spirituality is, as Betty expresses it, such a skiddy word, its avowed practitioner is ordinarily looked upon as someone apart from hearty living. I have sought to suggest that Betty was in no sense apart, apart from anything. She had a healthy and holy horror of anything resembling asceticism. She used and enjoyed to the full all of human life. "Asceticism means you are afraid of something," she pointed out. She had an equal horror of any taint of superiority, of the teacher attitude. Zest, joyousness, the glow of radiation, a genuine love for all things great and small. Simple elements of personality, but rarely to be met unalloyed. People felt the rarity, without recognizing it. One day, months after Betty's death, I was driving home from the city, with a friend, a businessman. "Wasn't it wonderful," he said out of a prolonged silence, "that they loaned us Betty for a little while?" Chapter 2. Everybody is psychic. There may have been, in the world's history, others who have been as rigorously and systematically trained as was Betty for her especial job of divulgence. If so, the details of their training, if recorded, have not come to my attention. The capacity for mediumship is beyond question a natural gift. But, like any other natural gift, it is of itself imperfect, unreliable in detail. Above all, without intelligent cultivation, it does not progress. Used prematurely or excessively, it often appears to deteriorate, perhaps finally to atrophy to nothing. There is close analogy to a natural singing voice that is used too soon or too much. No reasonable teacher allows that. He wants reliability, stability, and progress. Now Betty had this natural gift of mediumship to a high degree, but until 1919 nobody, not even she or I, recognized it technically. Her friends knew her as one with exquisitely delicate human sympathies and relationships, extraordinarily sensitive and responsive to the deeper beauties of life, and possessed of almost uncanny intuitions. Then occurred the small chance experience which presently she herself will describe. She found herself unexpectedly in what is called psychic touch with an unseen world. This is, of course, no very unusual occurrence. Indeed, since I came out openly on the whole subject, I've had so many people write me and recount their own experiences, that I am almost tempted to say it is a rather common occurrence. But most such persons run a standardized course. As it ordinarily goes, The psychic gets in touch, by one technique or another, with what seems indubitably to be discarnate intelligences. These latter give communications. Sometimes these communications are convincing enough to withstand skilled and dispassionate appraisal of genuineness, though even then, more often than not, they show a strong dash of coloring from the medium's subconscious. Both the new-fledged medium and the sitters are enormously impressed. They feel that to them is being confided a message of sacred trust. The world must be told of it. Indeed, not infrequently they feel they have been especially instructed to go forth and proclaim. The psychic has said, and the statement has been accepted at face value, "You are chosen to give forth a revelation." Naturally, this sense of almost sacred obligation results in a book or pamphlet, generally privately printed, distributed in all good faith, and with all confidence that it is going to arouse said world. Its failure to do so is a most disheartening and disillusioning puzzle. It should not be. There are really only two things wrong in the experience, though 9/10, perhaps even a larger percentage, of the effort is true and constructive. One of the two things is the assumption that the message is intended for the world. That is natural enough. Indeed, haven't they been so told? It is flattering to be especially chosen, and what reason, as yet, is there to doubt? But I am sorry to say that long and varied experience has made me leery of just that statement. It occurs too often. I am convinced it indicates either that the whole occurrence is phony, or that the medium's subconscious is at work. Not that the medium is really at fault, or exhibiting undue egotism. The material given is indeed important, if only a recasting of proverbial wisdom, and that importance exaggerates itself in the medium's subconscious. The message is real, but it is not addressed to the world, it is addressed to just those few people of that small group, fitting their need for the couching of old truths in language appropriate to their understanding, and is meant only for their own development and unfoldment. They are getting personal attention. It fits them. Also, many others in the world are getting personal attention. Very rarely, and only in emergency of world need, is the divulgence intentionally conveyed in such form as to merit widespread acceptance. That is why such books as Margaret Cameron's The Seven Purposes, Lodge's Raymond, in spite of all its obvious coloring, and the anonymous Our Unseen Guest commanded a public. An emergency existed. In Betty's case there seemed to be no such urgency. Quite the contrary, indeed. Nor were we told that we were especially selected, except for our own sakes. And it was nearly 18 years before we were allowed to think the job was in any way public. The Betty book did not come out until 1937, and that, I think, was conceded rather to satisfy our own uneasiness over the enormous accumulation of record, than because of any desire on the part of the invisibles. Before that, they had appeased our instinct for order by helping us put together an arrangement of the teaching comprised in the first 400 pages of records, covering the first year and a half. This was duplicated in 15 or 20 mimeographed copies, and had a wide lending circulation among personal friends and acquaintances. It was the basis on which, in 1935, some 15 years later, we began to build the Betty book. By that time the records had grown to 1,993 pages. Nevertheless, we were held, in the Betty book, to the material of that first year and a half, approximately those first 400 pages. Only a primer was called for, said the invisibles, hinting, but vaguely, that the more advanced work would be collated and dealt with later. The primer was not actually published until 1937. Encouraged by its reception, my brother and I plunged into selecting from the now bewilderingly abundant material, and emerged with the compilation we called Across the Unknown. This dealt with Betty's later experiences. It by no means exhausted the records, but we had more or less caught up to Betty, so to speak, and now we could go on with her in whatever were to be her further explorations. That looked like the job, and a good job it was. Therefore, when Betty fell so desperately ill, in 1938, we had every confidence in her recovery. She had been rigorously and carefully trained for 20 years, and seemed to us just to have arrived at the point of her real effectiveness as a tool, Surely that tool must be put to use. It did not make sense otherwise. Nevertheless, when she did die, we bad no feeling of frustration. The very circumstance of her death appeared to point the climax of truth to the whole episode of Dear Long Training. I wrote of that in the final chapter to Across the Unknown. I have quoted from it once before in the Unobstructed Universe. Nevertheless, here, for the third time, it appears in print as necessary background to the whole picture. You know, I wrote of my experience immediately following her death, the cozy, intimate feeling of companionship you get sometimes when you are in the same room, perhaps each reading a book, not speaking, not even looking at one another. It is tenuous, an evanescent thing, one that we too often fail to savor and appreciate. Sometimes, in fact, it takes an evening or two of empty solitude to make us realize how substantial and important it really is. Well, within a very few minutes that companionship flooded through my whole being from Betty, but in an intensity and purity of which I had previously had no conception. It was the same thing, but 100, 1,000 times stronger. And I realized that it more than compensated for the little fact that she had stepped across, because it was the thing that all our physical activities together had striven for. But, compared with this, had gained only dimly and in part. Why not? Actually, it was doing perfectly what all these other things had only groped for. So what use the other things? And why should I miss them? Does this sound fantastic? Maybe, but it is as real and solid as the chair I am sitting on. So much so that I have never in my life been so filled with pure happiness. No despair, no devastation, just a deeper happiness than I have experienced with her ever before, save in the brief moments when everything harmonized in fulfillment. This, I now believe, is the great blossom of which the Invisibles spoke, the final significance to which all of Betty's 20 years of work was to lead. Here is her concrete proof of one reward that can come to those who follow in her footsteps, her final evidence that her instrument of 20 years forging is strong enough to withstand the supreme test. So we imagine the job finished, except perhaps in the further use of material from the records. Then occurred my visit to renew friendship with Darby and Joan, of our unseen guest, and through Joan came Betty's divulgence of that amazing book, The Unobstructed Universe. Soon it was blazingly clear that without Betty's 20 years of training here in our obstructed universe, such a divulgence would have been totally impossible from her present unobstructed phase of living there, that it would be equally impossible for her to have given it from here, that, obscurely to us at first, but evident to us now, all along she and Joan had been developing apart as a team now to work together. That the job had just begun. As an end of effort, the previous two books fell into relative unimportance. They had been only indirectly part of the intention. They were parts of my training that happened to get published, said Betty, while giving the Unobstructed Universe. She did not deny the value so many people found in them. They were, and are, worthwhile. But, said she, they should really be read after this one. Curiously, as it seemed to us at the time, she had never taken much part nor great interest in the writing of the first two books, either on her own, or when she was working in her other consciousness with the Invisibles. These books, she told us, from that other consciousness, are not intended to reach many people, yet. But of the third book, from the very start, she, now a permanent dweller in the other consciousness, confidently predicted, "This is going to make a stir, this is going to be taken up by the scientists." We flatly disbelieved her. Fully as we recognize the novelty and value of the book's contents, we considered it limited in appeal to the small and very specialized public already interested in such things. We were wrong. It sold 12 printings in its first 3.5 months, it elicited literally hundreds of letters, it has been preached on from many pulpits. And, as for the scientists, I have dozens of letters, from all varieties of them, some of each sort professing to find in the book revolutionary principles that open to them new fields in their own specialties. In view of this, and in view of the fact that Betty promises us further divulgence in due time, an account of her 20 years of rigorous preparation seems now to be strongly indicated. Chapter 3: Betty's OWN Narrative. a few months ago, and quite by chance, I came across a number of folders in which Betty had filed a mass of papers and notes. Among them were sheets on which she had written down, apparently at irregular intervals, her own personal impressions concerning all this long arduous discipline and unfoldment. They are fragmentary and undated. I think perhaps they were notes for a personal narrative which was never undertaken. They do, however, give an invaluable background for the account of her training drawn from the actual records. The following, as far as it goes, is what Betty herself, in her own normal person, wrote of her thoughts and impressions concerning her experience. It is as she wrote it, except that I have here and there inserted a word obviously intended, or rearranged certain material out of logical order, but in no case have such slight alterations changed the sense. Most of us, her notes began, come into contact, sooner or later, with someone who has had experiences of a startling nature, something that points to the existence of powers beyond those we ordinarily possess. If such an experience happens to us personally, it is all the more arresting because we are forced to believe in it and try to explain it. Few things that can happen to us in the course of life are as thrilling, in the true sense of the word, as staggering, as these glimpses of an extension of our powers. Something long buried in us seems to come to the surface temporarily and convince us that the thing experienced is quite possible and true. I say temporarily, because at first it has tremendous tides. The high tide of our first enthusiasm has an ebb that drains away everything, leaving us far away from the original flooding inspiration. Then everything goes cold, flat and hopelessly inaccessible, if not actually repellent. It seems that the development of these higher powers within us runs a definite course, with symptoms almost as recognizable as measles. Exaltation and security, then flat tired incapacities of all kinds, and doubt. After suffering long from each symptom, as if it were fatal, I have tried to sum up the whole experience from the vantage point of 10 years of constant struggle. Why the struggle? I do not know. Certainly neither sorrow nor lack of life's experiences turned me to it. It must be born in people. Perhaps it was a gift from a long line of Scotch ancestors, all of whom seem to have had to struggle thus. At any rate, it has all happened along with an exceptionally busy adventuresome life, and a happily married one. To tidy up the subject in my own mind, I have hunted up some notes written in the very beginning of my psychic experiences. One night during dinner, we and a friend discussed a psychic's book I had been reading. The friend then told of her success in Russia at moving tables, and we were inspired to try it ourselves, solemnly swearing on honor to be honest in the experiment. After dinner the lamps were put out, and by the firelight, kneeling around a small table, with tips of fingers touching the top and our little fingers joined, we three sat quietly waiting. After a brief wait we were thrilled by a strange feeling of vitality in the table, and movement began. Until midnight we experimented, too spellbound with our own astonishing success to carry out our original engagement to go to the movies. The table tipped once for yes and twice for no, and moved around the room in designated directions. Next we tried pencil and paper and had a little success. Hearts were repeatedly drawn, love and Helen written, and a few uncertain attempts at words. These were done with a pencil held in one person's hand, with another person's hand placed lightly upon it, the elbows off the table. On a subsequent evening some friends came to call, bringing with them a ear board. With the usual protective veneer of suppressed hilarity, we proceeded to experiment with this. We tried the board with different combinations of people, receiving a jumble of sense and nonsense, vague advice on business, unremembered anecdotes of childhood playmates. Some of the names spelled out were familiar and others strange. The impression left was one of confusion, but also a certain bewildering credence. The first thing that really moved me was a message from my old colored nurse, an adored foster mother, who was with me from my birth to my marriage. Then came my mother, who had died in my babyhood, and called me daughter, a name strangely novel and beautiful to me as I had never known my parents. She urged me to try writing with a pencil. This in private I tried to do, with growing success each day. At first the letters all ran along together and had to be separated into words. I kept my eyes closed in order to free my mind of all outside distractions. But this was not so necessary later, except when my attention wandered or became concentrated on the words being written. The messages were very simple ones urging me to continue. But they brought me a strange and beautiful elation. My mother confirmed my lifelong impression that my family, nearly all of whom had died in my childhood, had been watching over me and trying to influence me for years. I was pathetically, almost frantically implored to have patience, faith and persistence in spite of failure or interruptions from opposing forces. Great insistence was made upon practice, constant practice, and keeping my mind a blank. This is only a weak beginning. You will develop rapidly if you will only follow our influence. Will you make a little shrine of yourself for us to work through? There are many of us trying to get at our loved ones. After a while you will be able to talk and act with us. We want you to begin to practice giving yourself up to us so that we can talk through you. It will take some time, for you cannot know our laws. Sit quietly a while, think of cosmic things, we will help. In the meantime a telegram had come with the sad news that Lizzie, a much loved and devoted friend and retainer of the family, had had a stroke of apoplexy and was unconscious. I asked the Ouija board if she would recover. Do not worry, she will not suffer long, she will come to us in 10 days, the board answered. I said, are you sure? About, was the answer. In 12 days she was dead, but by this time Betty had, I thought, abandoned the Ouija board for automatic writing. This may be a slip on her part, or she may indeed have recurred for this purpose to the earlier method. At about this time, also, came a sudden written message from Stuart's father, asking him to give financial aid to a friend of ours who needed capital to give him a business opportunity. Write a letter at once, now, the message urged, it is a question of time. We were at that moment in a friend's camp at some distance from a post office, with no known communication that day, but no sooner was the letter written than a man arrived who was delivering something and returning at once, and to him we entrusted the letter. Later it proved that time was an important element in receiving the information regarding the loan. These circumstances, or coincidences, if you prefer, has at least the effect of arousing our interest. We determined to investigate slowly and carefully and honestly each step, not letting ourselves be carried away by any desire of our own to believe or disbelieve. Mediumship was now being urged upon me in the messages. My first and second efforts at this caused a strange sensation of being lifted out of myself and almost slipping over the edge, as when just losing consciousness under ether. Before letting me go, however, Stuart demanded assurance that I was really in the hands of my friends and for this purpose asked for a test. His father was asked to give the name of an old lumberman employed years ago, a name unknown to me. A curious jumble of names of old lumberjacks came, all unknown to me, some of them known to Stuart, but the desired name did not come and the test failed. The next day this was written. It will be impossible for us to answer the tests for the present, because your father is not yet in our sphere and cannot communicate directly. As soon as that is made possible we will be able to convince you. At present it would only confuse you and not add to your faith. It is disappointing to us to have the delay, but we understand and do not blame you. It will be invaluable to have Stuart for us, so we must wait. We will let you know when we are ready for the tests. In the meantime we will write you regularly and try to prepare your mind for what we want you to do. We will not make you nervous. We promise that, and that no evil will come to you, for there are too many of us working over you. That is the great strength and hope of your particular case. It is all for your happiness. Dear child, fear not, tell Stuart to give you up to our care every day for a little while. From earliest times in the history of the race a few have experienced what you are now doing. It is now daily becoming more common, and we hope soon to be acknowledged before the world. Give your mind to thoughts of our love for you and yours for us. It is the stepping stone which brings us safely across. We cannot succeed without that. Love is a powerful medium of communication. So much depends on you, we can only succeed if you do your part. During this time and subsequently, Betty's notes go on, my mind was exalted with my secret. I was supremely happy. There followed, however, a sinking, haunting period of lack of faith in myself. All I had ever learned of the subconscious mind tormented me with questionings. Could I be hypnotizing myself with this thing? The beautiful nearness and protection, which had been a lifelong companionship, cherished in the very fiber of me, suddenly fell away, leaving me lonesome as a deserted soul. This temporary loss and struggle, in milder form, took place again and again after receiving various false predictions. Several books of similar experiences read about this time, and a wholesome and too lively sense of humor which occasionally brought on a childish and rather hysterically amused attitude towards the whole affair undoubtedly saved me at this period. My first experience of this kind of false prediction was astounding. I had asked a very foolish question, will I have a long life? The answer was, you will die. All this, the table tipping, Ouija board, the visit to the friend's camp, the death of Lizzie, I recall as having happened in 1919, S.E.W. Betty had always, though vaguely, felt herself under the care of the unseen. S.E.W. of cancer of the stomach in 10 months. Feeling a great personal interest in this statement and that something really should be done about it, I rallied a little efficiency and asked if I should go and have an X-ray taken. The answer was rather blighting to a happy psychic, no, it will do no good. I was not particularly depressed by this, strange as it may seem. My principal impression was that it was really sad for Stuart and that I must certainly hurry and finish up a lot of things at loose ends. It was honestly rather an exciting, stimulating thought, and if I could only persist in it, efficiency would be tremendously increased. At once, however, a less hurried hand wrote, you will live many happy years. This was my first experience with what I later learned to call the blind forces. I had been repeatedly warned to maintain my faith in spite of interruptions from opposing forces, so I was not altogether unprepared. A number of almost childish pranks followed at intervals. Curiously enough, in some there seemed to be an element of truth, perverted in transmission. For instance, while sitting at a table in a hotel dining room, my hand had a feverishly insistent desire to write. I took a menu, and on the back, with a haste which cramped my hand, received this message, your Aunt Nina is in danger. She is in an automobile wreck. It is on the Great East of Hollywood, this after a slight hesitation. Bertha will be injured. You will be called on the telephone to go to them. Do not leave the hotel this afternoon. We did not foresee it. Shortly afterwards my aunt and Bertha rang up and talked to me on the telephone, as hale and hearty as ever. On returning home, however, I found that at the time my butler and his wife had been in an automobile wreck which proved very serious for her, poor girl, as her face was badly scarred for life. A rather amusing prediction received in the same hurried manner, while on a streetcar and written on a paper torn from a package, announced that there would be a change in my fortunes, that I was to be left a large sum of money by someone the spirits had advised to leave it to me for their work. Rather a moral lecture followed, telling me to decide what was the most far-reaching benefit I could confer with it, and to act while I was in my prime, and giving me clearly to understand that I was not to use the money for myself in any way, that they would keep a suspicious eye on me. It continued, you do not believe, you are not as excited about this, as we are. We should like to talk to you more about this wonderful gift, but you seem apathetic, as indeed I was, for I knew that it was not true. At the end, this is not true, mother, was written. I felt quite resentful and indignant over these things, even though I had been more or less prepared to expect them, or some form of interference. Gradually, however, my faith grew until, even in the midst of my indignation over what seemed a very flagrant case of attempt to deceive me, I still never doubted that an explanation would be given, and my desire to continue was as strong as ever. Only the surface of me demanded that I assume an injured frame of mind, as of a virtuous person badly treated. Always, too, I guarded myself against too easy credulity. The etiquette of my world required certain apologies, but the Supreme Court within me was rather lenient about the whole disgraceful affair. There was no need in being huffy about it, for no satisfactory apologies were given. Outside of vague remarks about these scapegoat forces, every failure is hung on. As for example, thus, the forces which intruded on you yesterday will not be allowed to make an attack upon you again. I preserved a dignified and rejudicial silence, as there seemed nothing else to do.